Hey, as part of the Tony Curry Radio Podcast Network, a very special guest today, and my apologies to David Hammons, Grammy-nominated, award-winning producer, first of all, out of Fort Payne, for not having you on sooner. It's been super busy around here. I know you've been staying super busy, but first of all, brother, how have you been? What's been going on? Tell people a little bit about you, and obviously, very, very good friends with Mr. Jeff Cook, who just left this beautiful earth of ours, I guess a couple of days ago, and we have a lot to talk about your good friend Jeff, who I know you were friends with for 30 years. But how you been, man? Everything good?
Man, I'm doing great. Life is good when you love what you do and do what you love. You know, you understand that concept.
Sir.
It's awesome just to be in the studio and be creative and just to be in this environment where Jeff lives so much of his life here in the studio and working with him. But I'm doing great considering that we lost Cookie. I call him Cookie. Mm-hmm. I also call him Uncle Jeff and a few other names that run through my head, but I'm doing great.
I didn't know Jeff Cook personally. I had met him a couple of times, some golf tournaments, and obviously I knew you were good friends with him. Our good mutual friend Laughing Tim was just a huge friend of ours, and he would send me pictures all the time, and I know Braxton and some of his bandmates actually played with Jeff from his studios up there. But first of all, just talk about the man first. We'll get into his music and all the wonderful things he did, certainly from a solo standpoint, also from an Alabama standpoint. Just talk about Jeff Cook, the man, first.
Well, I met Jeff in 1980 at a red light in Fort Payne, and that's a whole funny story. And we just hit it off ever since then. And as far as the guy, he was never a star. He was just never a star. Even when he was a star, you know, when he became a star, he just never gave off that personality. He just wanted to be one of the guys and hang out and have fun. And he was the ultimate joke teller.
Really?
I mean, joke after joke. Jimmy Davis, I don't know if you know Jimmy or not. Jimmy is Hank Jr.'s road manager, stage manager. Mm-hmm. So Jimmy said it best. He said that had Cookie not have made it in music, he could have been a stand-up comic because he lived to tell a joke. Yeah. I mean, it was just, he was all about the joke. He liked three or four things, and fishing, joke telling, music. And it was kind of in that order. He loved to tell a joke. I'll give you an example. He called me one day. I wasn't here. He said, "Hey, are you coming to the studio tomorrow?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, we need to talk about something." And I thought, "Oh crap, I'm getting the axe or something," you know? So he had me the week before. We were going through his guitar amps. I was, and looking at what, 'cause we got tons of his vintage amps up here, vintage guitars. We were going through the amps. I was, and turning them on to see what was wrong with them, if anything. And I came across this one amp, and I was labeling everything. And I came across this one amp, and I wrote, you know, turns on but makes a humming sound. And I just labeled it. So Cookie calls, said, "Make sure you're coming up here. I want to talk to you." So I get here. I go upstairs to the office, and the very first thing he does is, "Hey, I got a question for you." He walks me down the hall. And I'm like, I'm confused. I have no idea what this is. And he said, "Hey, on this amp here," he said, "you wrote that it's humming. I just have one question." I said, "Okay." He said, "What song is it humming?" And he just died. I said, "You mean to tell me that you have called me up here? I'm thinking I'm going to get the axe. And you're just wanting to pull a joke the whole time." 24 hours he thought about this.
Sure. That's a great story. We're talking to a Grammy nominated award winning producer, David Hammons. He is out of Fort Payne, of course, a very good friend with Jeff Cook, or Cookie as you call him, who left us just a few days ago. You know, I think about two other artists, Prince and Eddie Van Halen. When they left us, they left an enormous amount of material. And I don't even know what you do with that type of material. You've been producing forever, and I'm sure you've got a lot of material. And we know that the bands that will work on some things, they'll put them back up, they'll bring them back out. Paul McCartney, for example, went through thousands of songs during COVID and finished up a lot of music that maybe it just wasn't its time. Sometimes you have to shelf something up to pull it back out to work on it again. Sometimes you listen to it different, hear it differently. What kind of material did Jeff leave in his studio, and what happens to that material, and how are you going to go through it?
Oh, wow. You have asked a really great question. I actually, about a year and a half ago, Alabama commissioned me to archive all their 2-inch reels that we had up here. So the process for that is you bake those in a convection oven to make sure that they don't have this sticky shed syndrome, which is another long story, but that you'll actually tear the tape up if it's not done properly and you won't ever be able to use it again. So I archived everything over to digital. And during that process, we began to realize that Cookie, over the course of his career with Alabama, in the studio, they would do 2 or 3, 4 extra songs each. So we have enough material just on Jeff that's never been released. I think there's 38 songs. 38 songs. It's like a double album. So Jeff and I, we were working on that, and I was working on the mixes for him. And we had it up here listening to it while he was still here. And he was just like, you know, he was just reliving the last, you know, 40 something years of his career and all that. Plus, I have a live show from the Bowery.
Wow.
It's on a little quarter inch reel.
I got goosebumps, man.
Man, it's incredible, all the material that's just not been released.
So you're talking about a band that had 33 number one songs. At one point, they had 21 straight.
No, they had 41.
40. I saw 33, 51 top tens. I mean, it's insane. At that point, I mean, it could have been 81. It's just amazing. So when you go back and listen to some of this archive material that I'm assuming goes all the way back to when the band formed in 1969, as Jeff was a co-founder. Mm-hmm. What do you hear? And obviously you're talking 40 plus years of material. I think there's this thought process that everything you'd hear is a hit, that everything must have been a hit, and why is it still why is it being archived, or why is it sitting in the box? Are you hearing bits and pieces of things? Are you hearing songs that obviously weren't completed? Are you hearing songs that maybe the band thought this is not good enough to be on our next album?
No, I'm all of that. Yeah. I'm hearing the predominant thing about Alabama, it was their harmony.
Yeah.
The tightness of the harmony, the way they sang their notes. And they would actually, a lot of times, cross voice. One who was on the low part took the high part and swapped out the way they did things. But I do have this. I have Feel So Right, the demo of Feel So Right before they had a record deal that sounded like nothing quite like what they put out eventually. So they had this demo of Feel So Right that had a steel guitar in it. And here's an interesting note about Alabama, the greatest country band ever. Never, ever in any song that they ever released or recorded did it have a steel guitar in it.
Wow. And how did it change the sound of the song?
There's no steel guitar. The way the song, the demo was, it had a steel guitar in it. But when Harold Shedd, their producer, did it, it just changed completely. It had more of an edge to it, and it didn't have that country sound. It had a more pop type sound to it.
This is David Hammond's very special podcast here, talking about the life of Jeff Cook, who co-founded Alabama and passed away recently. He had Parkinson's towards the end of his life. You produced a lot of their stuff and worked with them for a long period of time, and you've been commissioned to go through all their archives. Did they write songs that they thought would be better on mainstream radio? And the reason I ask is, obviously, you're talking about a band that they charted in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. I mean, they charted for 5 decades. Did they ever play up to radio? Did they ever think, you know, because they had a lot of songs that could have been top 40 hits, but it just wasn't their time to be a top 40 band. They were a country band. And a lot of people back in those days, now you have Shania Twain was notorious for it. She did a country album, and then she did the same songs as a contemporary album. Did they kind of stick to their guns on how they wanted to sound? Did they ever think, you know, if we change this up a little bit, we have a better shot of having a crossover?
No, they totally stuck to who they were.
Good.
And the area that they came from. They did not sell out to the industry. The industry bought into them.
Yeah,
is really what happened. I've been in this room when they were picking out songs for an album, and they would sit in a circle. Everybody here, Teddy would start the song playing. Randy would have his head down, be listening. And at the end of the song, he might do this, not say a word. At the end of the song, he would say, on the next song, he'd say, yeah, I like that. And the way Randy was listening, he wanted that song to touch him. These are the songs that they might have co-written or might not have written later on. And if that song didn't touch him, if he couldn't relate to that song, he felt like he could not sell it to the public as a performer. Wow. So he just, if it didn't relate, I'll give you an example on the 41 hit song CD that they did. They did the demo work for it here, and we were doing, there were three new songs on that double album, and one of them was called 5 O'Clock 500. So when Randy was singing the demo part of that, and he was getting ready to leave, and they were going to do the backing vocals after he left, and as he got to the door, he said, hey, y'all do this. Make sure you do this. When you say the hook line, 5 O'Clock 500, he said, make sure you say 500. 500, not 500. He said, because that's who we are. That's where we come from, and we're not going to change that.
That's a great story. David Hammons joins us here. He's a Grammy-nominated, award-winning producer, and just a joy to have you on talking about the life of Jeff Cook. You know, that bands don't last 50, 60 years. They just don't. And Alabama did, and I think they recently played a tour or a concert as recently as just 4 or 5 years ago, and obviously Jeff was having a hard time with that through his Parkinson's. And I think of the Rolling Stones, but to have the original band stick together and continue to play like that. And I know they hung it up several, Kiss is another band where they've hung it up and then they play some type of tribute and they're like, you know what, let's get back on the road. And next thing you know, they're all back out there again. What I think is so amazing about them is how they adapted and changed, not necessarily their sound. I don't even know what, it's not their brand, because like you said, they stuck to their guns. The fact that they were so relevant for so long of a period of time in one genre of music to me is just mind blowing. It's just crazy.
That's phenomenal. Absolutely.
I mean, it really is, because you don't see bands chart in the 70s and then chart again in 2001. You just don't see it. You don't see it happening. And I don't know if that is a justification of the country genre, which a lot of people thought was going to be out the window in the mid-80s. It certainly has changed a lot. Let me ask you this, and I think I got into country music. Alabama got me into country music. I was always a classic rock guy. You know, Charlie Daniels Band, Marshall Tucker Band, even Lynyrd Skynyrd to an extent had a little bit of a twang to it that it was kind of fit, but it was always a classic rock sound. And there was transitional periods in country music that I think were really important. They were part of all three, but you had the Conway Twitty parts, and the Loretta Lynn parts, and, even, the Hank Williams Sr. parts. And then it kind of moved into that late '60s, seventies, maybe even early '80s part of the Ronnie Millsaps and the Vince Gills and the Keith, Whitney and the John Andersons and the Randy Travises. And I think Alabama just absolutely floored that area. And then of course you got into, to what we know as country music now. How did they feel knowing that almost every single song they put out seemed like it was going to be a number one hit? Did they like the way music was changing? What did Jeff think about country music today? I guess is what I'm trying to ask in a long roundabout way.
I think Jeff, he is a child of the 50s and 60s, and he loved that rock and roll era. His favorite guitar player was James Burton. I've got a James Burton Telecaster here. I'll show you here in a minute.
Yeah, please.
His other favorite guitar and favorite band was the Ventures from the 50s and 60s.
Wow.
Noki Edwards, the lead guitar player for there. We did a song for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that Jeff played lead guitar on as part of Noki's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so as far as what Jeff thought about, he loved all kinds of music. Yep. He loved gospel. He loved that rock edge. He loved Ricky Nelson, any of that type of stuff like that. And he loved his version of country music. I don't really think that Jeff listened to a lot of other artists during his career. I mean, they did their music. He did his music with Jeff Cook and the All-Star Good Time Band. He did that on the side. And I don't think he really had an opinion of what was happening outside of his realm, really.
David Hammons joining us here. Of course, David is an award-winning producer out of Fort Payne, was great friends with Jeff Cook, who just left us, and we're talking about his life, and it's just, I mean, it's just amazing to go through it. I spent about 2 hours this morning because I wanted to have good questions for you, and I know I've screwed a couple of them up, but I just love hearing you talk about him because I was such just a huge fan of him, and because of you and Laugh and Tim, who was a good friend of his. You mentioned the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Dolly Parton just recently got in at the age of 75, and she had mentioned the fact that, you know, it's, and people have to get past this whole Rock Hall of Fame. It's a Hall of Fame. It's a Music Hall of Fame. And yeah. She said she didn't want to be in it because she was a country music star. Alabama has been on the docket to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for 20 years. What were their thought process? Do they care about getting in? They'll get in. I can't imagine why they wouldn't, because every genre is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What's their thoughts on that?
I really wouldn't know their opinion on it, but in my opinion, I don't think that, you know, they would be honored, obviously, to be there. So I really don't know what their opinion of it would be, other than I think that they would be honored just to be in that. Any kind of recognition that they could get for their hard work, I think that they would appreciate it.
You are a producer. You have dealt with thousands of bands in your studio, and I imagine that it's not always shits and giggles. There are probably some times where you guys got guys going after each other. You're taking some songs where it probably takes you 15 minutes to produce, and you probably get songs where it takes 15 days to produce. Tell me what it's like to be in the studio with the band Alabama, and how did Jeff Cook play into the dynamics of how a band can stay together that long and not break up?
Working in the studio with those guys is a pleasure. Now, I think you mentioned a while ago that I was one of their producers. I've never produced them, but I've worked on engineering stuff here. Yeah. With their engineers. They have this formula that they work with their people, you know, all the time. And so I'm just one of the engineers. Gotcha. At that point. But as far as the dynamic that Jeff brought, his guitar tones and the way he bent strings made you think that it was a steel guitar. Because most people, when you say, oh, there's not a steel guitar in that. Yeah, I know I heard a steel. No, you didn't. You heard Jeff bending strings the way that a steel guitar might. Yeah. I asked him he could play a steel guitar. I asked him one time, I said, well, why don't you, he said, do you know how heavy those things are to carry on stage? He said, I really don't want to do that. But as far as their dynamic in the studio, what is most memorable to me is just how easy they work with each other in the studio. And you've got Randy, who is obviously the face and the voice. You've got Jeff, who's the musician. You got Teddy, who is, in my opinion, who is the ear.
Yeah.
We've been here, and Randy would be singing a song, and Teddy would say, and I got videos of all this stuff, Teddy would say, no, stay off of that note. That's going to be my note. You sing the one below that. Wow. So they would cross each other in that. So Teddy was really the ear. Like I say, the three of them worked so well together because they each had a role.
Yeah, there was a great story about Malcolm Young of AC/DC. He was the ear of AC/DC, and they were producing the Back in Black album down in the Bahamas, and they only had about 8 days. They had enough money for 8 days in the studio, which isn't a long time to produce an entire album. And Malcolm heard this sissing sound and could not figure out what the sound was, and no one else in the band could hear. They're like, Malcolm, it's fine. He's like, no. So they started taking out each piece of the song. I think it may have been Hell's Bells. And they're taking out each piece, and they must have gone through 16 different tracks, and he could still hear it. And the rest of the guys were like, I don't hear anything. It was a sand crab that was inside the bass drum that was scratching on the bass drum, and he could hear that. So to have those ears is so eerily important for a band. So the fact that they were in there was just amazing, and the fact they stuck together, and they all had a vision, I guess. Let me ask you this: when you're talking about a band that's been together as long as Alabama has, there are times where you feel like you must adapt to the sound of what the genre is now. Did you ever have anybody in the band, or maybe Jeff included, saying, listen, maybe we need to move in a little bit of a direction? Or how did the whole songwriting process and the actual production or engineering process go with those guys?
No, they never did I ever hear that they said that they wanted to adapt a sound. They just did what they did, and they did not tried to chase a direction, even though country music, you know, at this point, country music's moved way away from Alabama,
yeah,
in a sense. But country music will always, it will always at some point center itself. It'll go this way for a while. It'll go this way for a while. And then you'll have the twang come back in, and it'll be popular. You know, so it's just, it's constantly going, trying to find a different direction, but it just can't. It always comes back to the roots of country music, which is, you know, your Loretta Lynn's and your Dolly Parton's, your Patsy Cline's, those mm-hmm. type things are going to always come back around. For a while, you didn't hear a lot of steel guitar.
Yeah.
And now it's come, it's back. For a while, you heard a lot of the rap type beats and the bro country and the rap involved in the country. And so it you'll still hear some of that, but it's going to always center itself back up.
How important was it for the band Alabama to be true to the roots of Fort Payne, Indiana? Fort Payne, Alabama. I know there's some country acts out of Fort Payne, Indiana too, but everyone's going to Nashville now. And they're like, if you want to make it, you got to go to Nashville. And it's a great city. It's a music city, but how important was it to keep to their brand of the great state of Alabama and their band name?
Well, it was very important. Where their roots, where they're from, was everything about their songs. And it was very important. I'll give you an example about that. When I was 21, and my band opened up for Alabama at the first two June Jams. And there was a banquet. And they set my band, you know, way in the back. And Randy and them are all up here in the front. And so Randy stands up and he said, "Hey, I want to recognize these guys in the back. They're going to open up for us at the June Jam." And he had us stand up and everything. And, you know, after it was over with, he came back and talked to us. And we talked about moving to Nashville. And he said, "Why would you want to?" Wow. He said, "I didn't."
Yeah.
He said, "You guys should just hang out here and do what you do. And if you make it, you do. If you don't, you don't." He said, "It takes a lot of luck." Now, we had inroads in Nashville, and Alabama opened up a lot of doors for us. But that was Randy's thing and the whole group's thing. It was, they needed to come back here where they could actually walk down the street and nobody bother them.
And
right. He said, "Well, you know, I've ridden by the movie theater before, and there would be Randy and his kids out there going in. Nobody's bothering them. They're just standing in line." You know?
They may have been the most accessible country music superstars that we'll ever have. Because
for sure, here.
You don't have that. Let me ask you one final question, then I want to see that guitar, and I want you to share at least one good story that you and Jeff Cook enjoyed together. What kind of collaborative efforts did Alabama have with other artists? I know that Lionel Richie did Deep River Woman. I know but what were some of the collaborations that Jeff worked with, and certainly Randy and the rest of the guys in Alabama, that they really enjoyed?
Well, now the Deep River Woman was incredible. And you know, Brad Paisley, they worked with Brad, Jason Aldean, Jamie Johnson. All of these artists have intertwined with them at some point, and they have been good for Alabama has been great for their career and has influenced their career. Alabama still does the Songwriters Night once a year at the college to raise money, and it's always very special to see that. So those collaborations have meant a lot to them, to be recognized by other artists that actually want to do something with them, and that they want to do something with other artists too. So that's just been a big plus for everybody in the industry, actually.
All right, give me a good Jeff Cook story before we let you go.
Okay. So we had a studio session scheduled, and they required a B3 Hammond organ. And we had to rent one because we didn't have one. So I rented one. They pull it off the truck 3 hours before the session. They bring it in, and it doesn't work. And I said, "We got to have one in like 2.5 hours. So they call, find another one at the church, go to the church, pick it up, get it down here. Long story short, it was immaculate. I had never seen one in this great a condition. It even had the original lettering on the assignment keys. Wow. So after the session, I asked the guy, I said, "Hey, can you leave this here for a couple of weeks? Cookie will be back in off the road." And I said, "I think he might buy it. What's the price?" And he told me. Cookie comes in, plays it. He said, "Oh, man, I love this." And he said, "How much?" And I said, "That's too much." let's look, see if you can get them down. So we went back and forth. I did with the owner of the company and Jeff. And it was like, we got down to within $1,000 of each other. Okay. And they wasn't moving. Cookie wasn't moving. And I thought I was going to lose it. I said, I called Jeff. He's on the road. I said, man, I said, look, I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put up $1,000 of my own money if you'll just get this organ. He said, you would, really would, wouldn't you? He said, yeah. He just died laughing. He said, no, man. He said, if you do that, if we can make money on it, if we sold it tomorrow. And I said, yes, we could. He said, I will buy it. And so it's been here ever since. But that's just Jeff. He was very conservative with his money.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. I mean, he walked in here one day with a keyboard. A nice keyboard. And he said, man, I found this at a yard sale on the way up here. I bought it for $110. And we've still got it back here. Sounds great.
That is great. Hey, real quick, what other instruments did Jeff love playing?
He enjoyed piano. He was probably a better piano player than he was a guitar player.
Wow.
He just never got to play it. And that's the truth. He could play the Jerry Lee Lewis stuff and just kill it. He was something.
That's amazing. All right, show me that guitar.
Yeah. Well, I've got two or three.
I want to see him, man.
All right, this one is incredible. This is called the Robin.
Wow.
It's a double neck. Oh. Let me make sure I can kind of get it in there.
I see it.
It's a double neck, but the color on it, and I'll bring it closer, that is all airbrush.
That's incredible.
And the guy that does all of Jeff's airbrush, his name was Wayne Jarrett, and he just did all kinds of work for him. That is so cool.
That is beautiful.
I actually took a screenshot of that one time and made it my screensaver on my computer.
That is awesome. That is incredible.
We've got a James Burton Telecaster, and James was Cookie's favorite guitarist.
Look at that. That is incredible. That is beautiful.
Is. Absolutely. And I got a microphone if I've got time to share that story.
Yeah, I love. Yeah, absolutely.
So this is an M49B Neumann, or Neumann as some people call it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get that shot at it. We've had this microphone for a while, and it went through hard times, so to speak. It was stolen. And since we had the serial numbers and everything, it was located at a pawn shop in Las Vegas.
Really?
So we got it back. Absolutely. This was made in the 50s, 40s and 50s. That's how old it is. It sounds incredible. It's all original. So it was stolen. We were able to recover it and get it back. And then Randy Owen sang sang Angels Among Us on that microphone. And then it came missing again, and we couldn't find it. And so I was going through the production room one day, and there were two big boxes of t-shirts. So I went through the first box, and I said, it's just t-shirts. And I moved it over the side. So I just went over and picked up the other one. I was not going to go through it.
Yeah.
And I moved it, and I thought, something doesn't feel right about that. And I brought it back over, and I uncovered all the, and there it was in the bottom of that t-shirt box. Somebody was going to steal it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the thing was. So I looked up the value of that one microphone. It's just on Reverb. You can buy one of that era for $16,000. Okay. So now you add the story to this microphone. I mean, it becomes priceless.
It really does.
It's had its own life.
The DNA in that microphone is probably just absolutely amazing. Hey, David, exactly. Man, thank you so much for your time. I know a lot of people have been hitting you for interviews and stuff, and greatly appreciate your time. You know you're welcome to come to my studio anytime. I could sit here and talk to you for hours. Greatly appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us. And please keep in touch and let me know what's going on, okay?
All right, brother. Love you.
Love you too, man. Good to see you too, brother.